Oh, no more mammy and no more pappy. Ain't we lucky, oh, ain't we happy? Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy now. Sex galore, but no more marriages. No one pushing baby carriages. No one has to change a nappy. Ain't we lucky, oh, ain't we happy? Everybody's happy now. Oh, dope for tea and dope for dinner. Fun all night and love and laughter. No remorse the morning after. Where's the sin and who's the sinner? Everybody's happy now. Girls pneumatic, girls exotic, girls ecstatic, girls erotic. Hug me, baby, make it snappy. Everybody's oh so happy. Everybody's happy now. Lots to eat and hours for drinking. So more cocktails and no more thinking. No more thinking. No more thinking. Oh, everybody's happy now.
And that was Chris Mayville's version of Aldous Huxley's Everybody's Happy Now. And it's time for Gnostic Media's podcast number 217. I'm your host, Jan Urban. This episode brings us back to the topic of health and is called Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox, and was recorded on Monday, October 20, 2014, and is being released on Friday, October 24. My guest is Dr. Kate Ram Blue, ND. Kate Ram Blue is a doctor of naturopathic medicine and author. A former faculty member at the Canadian College of Naturopathic Medicine, Dr. Kate is an expert in the field of natural health and speaks internationally on many topics related to natural medicine. She is the author of the book Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox, How a Little-Known Vitamin Could Save Your Life. And her website is Dr. Kate ND.com. And her website and other episodes related to this episode will be posted to the Gnostic Media website. And I met Dr. Kate at the Bulletproof Conference put on by Dave Asprey a few weeks ago. And of course, Dave has been on this show twice. And also episodes related to this one include Michael Adams' interview, Curing MS with the Paleo Diet, and Rami Nagel, Back to Paleo, Curing Tooth Decay Naturally, and Dr. Peter Glidden's two interviews, Killing Us Softly, and Dr. William Davis, Wheat is Murder, and also Sally Fallon's two interviews on The Oiling of America. And donations. This episode is brought to you by Thomas, Paul, Tino, Robert, and two different Casey's. Thanks to all of you. And I should also mention we did have one Bitcoin donation this week from 1Q9AQZ. Thanks also to you. And of course, as I say each episode, we do everything we can to provide everything at Gnostic Media for free. But your donations and website purchases and ordering a membership, etc., are what keep us going. And I think this is the second to the last interview for season 6 of the Gnostic Media podcast. So I believe we'll have one more before we wrap it up for the 6th year. But that the 6-year archive will also be up on the Gnostic Media website next week. And let's see, also up there are the bumper stickers, bookmarks, books, DVDs, She Who Remembers archives, t-shirts, etc. And the views expressed by the authors and guests are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. The website is gnosticmedia.com, G-N-O-S-T-I-C-media.com. Reach me through the contact form on the website or directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com. Thanks for listening and thank you for your support. And here's my interview with Kate Ram Blue, Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox. Enjoy. All right, Kate, welcome to the Gnostic Media Podcast. It's good to have you here.
Thank you. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And this is episode number 217, and your full name is Kate Ram Blue, and you're the author of, when did you publish this book?
It first came out in 2011.
And here is the book here, Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox. And I did read about 90% of it. I think I may have skipped chapter 7, but I think I read even chapter 8. So anyway, Kate, welcome to the show. And why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about yourself? Who is Kate Ram Blue?
Well, I am born and raised in Montreal, Quebec. I thought I was going to be a medical doctor following in the footsteps of an older sister who is a conventional medical doctor. And the more time I spent as a keen pre-med student, volunteering in the hospital, that type of thing, the more I realized there was kind of something missing for me there. And through my own health challenges, I found my way to naturopathic medicine and went down the path of being a naturopathic doctor, which, where I live, is a licensed primary care physician. But rather than seeing somebody for a very short period of time and prescribing medicines to treat a symptom, we try to look at the whole person, treat the underlying cause of problems, often with nutrition, natural supplements, and other natural ways of looking at trying to heal the whole person.
Now, I had met you, about 3 weeks ago, I suppose, almost 4 weeks ago at Dave Asprey's Bulletproof Conference. You were one of the presenters there, and I actually wanted to have you on first. I thought that your information was very good and covers a lot. So, by the way, thanks for the copy of the book that you gave me there at the conference as well, and I know you left it up there at the front desk for me, which probably cost you an extra trip back and forth or something, but...
Glad to do it.
So first off, and we'll touch on some of the things as we go through that overlap with Dave's and that, conflict with possibly Dave Asprey's information or Dr. William Davis's information, et cetera. And they've all been guests on the show here, as well as Sally Fallon and everybody. So welcome for that. You can join the nice club for that. And so let's start off. What is vitamin K2?
Vitamin K2 is a long overlooked, ignored, misunderstood fat-soluble vitamin that is arguably as important as vitamin D. It works with vitamin D for a lot of health benefits and actions in the body. And it has several roles. The main one is that it helps move calcium around the body. So vitamin D, for example, will help you absorb calcium. But then vitamin K2 tells it where to go. So guiding calcium into your bones and keeping it, arguably more importantly, out of your arteries, keeping your arteries free and clear. It also has other roles to play in testosterone production, cancer protection, prevention, insulin sensitivity and resistance, and cognitive function. So there are really a number of very, very important health roles of vitamin K2. But again, it's a nutrient that was really overlooked and misunderstood for a long time.
And how did you become involved in studying K2? And how do you pronounce its scientific name, minoquinone?
Minoquinone.
Okay.
Yeah, minoquinone. I read Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston Price probably back in about 2006 maybe, and thought it was really fascinating. And I put the book aside, although start to sort of incorporate some of that philosophy into my diet and whatnot. About 6 months later, I started to come across some articles about vitamin K2. And as soon as I started reading about it and its actions in the body, I thought, hey, I'm sure Price spoke all about this in his book. I was pretty excited. So I went and dug up my copy of Nutritional Physical Degeneration, looked all through it. And I was stumped because I couldn't find anything about vitamin K2, and I couldn't figure out why I had that impression and why I couldn't find the information. Anyway, fortunately, there was a a genius article by Chris Masterjohn that came out about a month after that to put me out of my misery. It linked Price's Activator X to vitamin K2. And this is really when I got hooked on this nutrient. One, because I felt like there was a story that went back quite a long way that needed to be told about this vitamin, but also because there was so much modern research about it and its health implications, and nobody was talking about it. So those were some of the reasons, or sort of how I heard about it and some of the reasons why I got onto it.
And what is the difference between vitamin K1 and K2? And I know there are many, so...
Well, there are many, and this is a really important question, because the differences between these two nutrients is one of the reasons why vitamin K2 was overlooked for so long. So the K, you know, vitamin K, it's actually a family of vitamins, two main members, K1 and K2. Vitamin K1 comes from green leafy vegetables. That's where you'll find them in nature and in your diet. And its main role is in blood clotting. The K actually comes from coagulation, from the German spelling. And that's the main role for vitamin K1, is in blood clotting. Vitamin K2 doesn't generally participate in blood clotting. It doesn't come from green leafy vegetables. And it's easy, much easier to become deficient in vitamin K2. So there are lots of differences between the two nutrients, but they were sort of confused and mixed up for a long time. And still sometimes you find information that says that confuses them.
For about 70 years, they were confused. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So what is the calcium supplement paradox?
Well, the calcium supplement pill, the calcium paradox and the supplement paradox is the idea that, of course, we know that we need calcium in our bodies. We need it especially for bone health, but all kinds of things. And that's the reason why people take calcium supplements. And yet studies are showing that that may be doing more harm than good. Studies saying that people who take calcium supplements have 20 to 30% more heart attacks and strokes than those who don't take calcium supplements. There are other studies, of course, that have come out since then challenging that. Anytime you have a study that says one thing, a study will, you know, might come along to challenge that. So, you know, there is a chance that calcium supplements aren't increasing our risk of heart attack and stroke. I hope that's the case. You know, based on the current information, I think that they might actually be doing that. But regardless of whether or not you're taking a calcium supplement, excess calcium, when it deposits in the arteries or anywhere in the body, but in the arteries it's most life-threatening, will lead to heart attacks and strokes. And that's really where the calcium paradox comes from. It's a double-edged sword. We need calcium in our bodies, but we need it to be in the right places. And if it's not, big problems can ensue. And this is where vitamin K2 comes in, because it helps put calcium back in its place.
Now, let me stray off topic here for a second. Let's say you're taking calcium supplements and vitamin K2 supplements. Would those two be okay together, or should we be getting this stuff from natural sources? You know, I noticed that the majority of your book does focus on food sources, and then somebody attacks you online for, you know, talking about vitamins, and I'm like, well... Yeah. You know, so
well, you have to address supplements, because the fact is people are taking them. And that was actually the jumping off point of the book. And definitely, well, first of all, I don't recommend calcium supplements to everybody all the time, or even all women all the time. I think if you have osteoporosis, there is something to be said for a calcium supplement. As to whether vitamin K2 will protect us from what calcium supplements may be doing, I think that it would. That still remains to be studied. But we do know that whether or not you're getting your calcium from your diet or your supplements, that it can land in your arteries, because heart attacks and strokes caused by this calcification of the arteries is the number one killer of people, whether or not they're taking a calcium supplement. And we know that K2 has been shown to prevent and even reverse arterial calcifications. That's its role in the body. So, like I said, I don't recommend calcium supplements in general. They have their place in certain small amounts, but if you're going to take a calcium supplement, you better be taking vitamin K2.
All right. calcium supplements and damage. What damage can be caused from them?
Well, essentially, you see an increase in the deposition, the calcification in the coronary arteries in particular. And we know that the amount of the actual volume of calcium present in the coronary arteries is an excellent predictor of your risk of having a heart attack. And so basically more calcium in those areas is a bad thing. And this is really where the information is suggesting, the research is suggesting that calcium supplements are exacerbating this problem.
What is arterial sclerosis and how, in your opinion, is it caused?
So atherosclerosis is this literally hardening of the arteries, this buildup of plaque and calcium. And for a long time, the focus around heart disease was around cholesterol and saturated fat. The idea being that, or how a lot of people were understanding their notion of it, was that the arteries are like pipes and fat clogs it up, much like fat would clog up like a greasy pipe, and then that would cause the problem. But in fact, that's really not how it happens. And what really, first of all, sets off this hardening of the arteries and the atherosclerosis, first of all, is inflammation. That's what starts this problem. That's why you see, for example, severe advanced plaque and even sudden heart attacks in runners. You think, well, exercise is the absolute best thing you can do for yourself, right? Well, to a certain point, running up to, I think it's 15 miles a week, is good for your heart, your cardiovascular system, and your health in general. But over that, and for people who are marathon runners, we see something called runner's plaque, which is way more hardening of the arteries leading to heart attacks in people who run long distances. And that is caused by inflammation. Running for that long causes inflammation in the body. And that sets off a process in the throughout the body, but just, you know, looking at the arteries, that sets off a process which eventually leads to calcium depositing in those arteries. And when that calcium starts to build up, that hardening of the arteries, that's what eventually causes the heart attack. So it's a combination of the inciting event is this inflammation, and then that eventually encourages the calcium to deposit. And so you want to look at reducing the inflammation as well as removing the calcium. This is where vitamin K2 comes in, and by removing the calcium, and it happens to have anti-inflammatory properties as well.
And what would, what would lead to the inflammation there?
Well, in the example I just gave, it was excess exercise, because exercise, in short or moderate amounts is good, but in too high amounts, in this particular case, it will just lead to inflammation. That's well known. But inflammation can come from stress. It can come most commonly from diet. People who are typically eating too much sugar or things that elevate their blood sugar, and that is very inflammatory, and eventually that leads to a process of hardening of the arteries, not fat consumption, but sugar consumption.
And yes, that's what I was leading to. Sugar, carbohydrate consumption in general is.
Yeah.
All right. So why is vitamin D a problem?
Vitamin D is a big potential problem because although we know vitamin D has a lot of amazing health benefits and vitamin D deficiency is common, many people have gotten on the vitamin D megadose bandwagon. Now, there is too much of a good thing, and there is, more importantly, you need a balance of these nutrients. So vitamin D does a lot of things in the body. A big thing that it does is that it will cause you to absorb more calcium from your diet and food. So if you've got low bone density and you want to try to get more calcium into your bones and your body, this can be helpful. You want to absorb more calcium. But once the calcium is absorbed, vitamin D has no control over where the calcium goes. So the side effect of too much vitamin D is inappropriate calcification. Calcium will deposit in arteries, in other kinds of soft tissues, places where it shouldn't go. So there's been a big debate about how much vitamin D should you take. And, camps saying you shouldn't take more than 400 IUs, other camps saying you should take 10,000 or 50,000 IUs. And the fact is, how much vitamin D you should take, the answer is it depends. And it depends in large part on how much vitamin K2 is in your body, because the K2 will take the calcium that the D has made you absorb and move it around. And unfortunately, a lot of people, or you know, a significant minority of people who discover my work, discover it because they have had side effects from taking too much vitamin D. And I have one person who contacted me. He'd been taking something like 30,000 IUs of vitamin D every day for 6 months, then had a massive heart attack and was told that all of his arteries were entirely calcified. And that's just, that's what vitamin D can do to you. So we just need to keep it in balance.
Wow, that's taking things to the extreme, I would say. Yeah. All right, so what are some of the health issues that vitamin K2 deficiency causes?
So K2 deficiency will exacerbate or lead to atherosclerosis. So that's building up of calcium where it shouldn't be. Other places where we see calcium building up, the carotids, any of the blood vessels, both the arteries and the veins. In the veins, we can see varicose veins, the calcification and hardening of the walls of the blood vessels. And so then we also have any kind of like heel spurs, bone spurs, kidney stones, just calcium building up in the body in areas where it shouldn't. Then we have a lack of calcium in places where it should be, so osteoporosis. As well as, you know, calcium aside, vitamin K2 plays a role in protecting us against cancer. It has a role in regulating cell growth. So when K2 is deficient, there's a number of cancers that are more common, lung and prostate, leukemias. And there's also implications for testosterone production. K2 has been shown to stimulate testosterone production, as well as diabetes, so insulin sensitivity. And insulin resistance is something that is associated with low K2 levels.
Who first discovered vitamin K2?
Well, technically, the person who first discovered a vitamin K2 is the same as the person who discovered a vitamin K1, Enric Dam. He won the Nobel Prize, actually, for the discovery of vitamin K1. And he noticed at the same time that there was this other form, K2, but essentially figured, man, K1, K2, it's the same thing. I think that in a more meaningful way, Weston Price discovered a vitamin K2, but he didn't name it. So he doesn't get the props, you know, mostly for that.
Yeah, these days, Weston A. Price is getting a huge amount of attention, though, long after his death.
Mm-hmm.
So how did vitamins K1 and K2 confuse researchers for decades?
Because they noticed that, so they discovered K1, saw it was important in blood clotting. K2 structurally seemed similar enough that researchers kind of assumed they were the same. And in some, you know, small ways, there is a little bit of an overlap between their actions, enough to confuse people or think, man, they probably just basically are two versions of the same thing. And it wasn't really until the 70s, a couple studies there, and then really up until about 2007 that researchers were firmly able to demonstrate, no, K1 and K2 are pretty distinct. They have different actions in the body. K2 does things that K1 just can't do, and that it's more than just blood clotting. So it's relatively recent that we really have been able to appreciate this big difference.
All right, so getting back to Weston A. Price, who is he and what were his discoveries?
So Weston A. Price is a dentist, originally from Canada, but then moved down to the U.S., so I think we can both lay claim to him. He was basically wondering why his practice was so busy. Why did people have such bad teeth and were so unhealthy in general? And he wanted to study healthy people, couldn't find as many as he would like in North America, and so began to travel around the world. This is back in the 1930s. Made it to the far corners of the globe and found healthy people around the world. To make a long story short, he noticed that even though healthy people had diets that varied tremendously, their diets all provided similar nutrients and similar levels of nutrients that were much higher and more nutritious than the diets of North America of those days, the 1930s. and that the diets provided a lot of fat-soluble vitamins, 10 times the amount we get nowadays or compared to the diets of the 30s. Who knows, that might be 20 times compared to what we get now. So lots more vitamin A, lots more vitamin D, and lots more of a third vitamin that was a fat-soluble vitamin, but they couldn't identify. And so he just called it Activator X. And for a long time, he did quite a bit of research on Activator X, and for a long time, the identity of that nutrient was a mystery until, well, again, 2007, when very compelling evidence linked Activator X to vitamin K2.
And another amusing comment I found regarding your book was that you had just taken all of Weston A. Price's information and copied it over, but it's like, you know, I've read your whole book, and it's very different in that regard. Now, why do you suppose that, I don't know, maybe we were propagandized, but, you know, why are we given the assumption that native peoples all over the world had these really poor diets and really poor oral health? And, you know, and I suppose you could probably think of the same thing. And, you know, in the 17 and 1800s, when people didn't eat a whole lot of refined sugar and flour, and they mostly ate a high fat, high protein diet. So, you know, where did this propaganda about these indigenous cultures and older diets come from, and we're so much healthier and rah-rah now?
That's a good question, and I'm not sure the answer to that. There's probably a few factors there. And if anything, a lot of that would come from a lot more recent sort of information or evidence about the impact of modern diets on native people, which seems to be worse than for the impact on other groups of individuals. And if anything, maybe that's where it came from. And I even give a few examples in my book of that. But it certainly is really a myth. And it's that's why I find, to be honest, Weston Price's work so compelling, because there's lots of people that seem that come up with ideas about what we should eat and then look for evidence to support that. Whereas, you know, Price, he just went around the world and looked what actually people were eating, which was not what he expected, and just described that and then draw conclusions from that. And that, to me, is compelling.
All right. There are other forms of vitamin K, which include 3 through 7. And I think you even had an 8 and a 9 or something like that in there as well. So what are these other forms?
So there are, yeah, vitamin K3, you might hear a little bit about that. Sometimes it's added to pet food. It has been used in some cancer research, but it's quite toxic. It's not something that is required in a nutritional sense. And similarly, vitamin K, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7. These ones have some use, but not really nutritionally. They never have made up a main part of our diet. Now, those shouldn't be confused with subtypes of vitamin K2, and we can get into those later on.
Right. Let me stop you right there, because so what's the difference between this K7 and MK7?
Good, very good question, and there is a big difference. So, like I said, there's two main families that, for nutritionally, that we need to be concerned about: vitamin K1 and K2. There's one type of vitamin K1, pretty much, but vitamin K2 in our diets, it comes in a number of different forms. So, there's, you could say, subtypes of vitamin K2: minoquinone 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. The numbers refer to the length of the molecular tail on this structure, and actually the length of the tail and the number, it changes a little bit the food sources that we find it in and how it acts in our body. So that does become important when you're understanding where K2 comes from in your diet and what you're buying, if you're buying a vitamin K2 supplement. But again, it shouldn't be confused with other types of vitamin K, which aren't really nutritionally important.
What food substances does K1 derive from?
Vitamin K1, green leafy vegetables, very, very easy, you know, and it's, you can very easily get in your diet. The body recycles it. So even if you just, you know, eat the parsley on the side of your plate once in a while, chances are you're getting lots of vitamin K1 in your diet.
And so is K1 deficiency common, and what are its symptoms?
very, very uncommon to be deficient in vitamin K1. The symptoms of K1 deficiency are also obvious. It's bleeding, because this is the blood clotting vitamin. If you're lacking in it, you will notice, you know, either easy bruising or bleeding in some way. And that's usually secondary to some other health problem, like a liver disease. It's rarely due to a lack of intake of vitamin K1, because the body uses it so efficiently. So very rare to be deficient in K1.
What about vitamin K2 deficiency? Is it common?
Yeah, so that's a completely different story. It is fairly common, actually. We don't have the same mechanisms to recycle vitamin K2 because it has other actions in the body. We just never developed that. And multiple studies now have shown that vitamin K2 deficiency is, in fact, very common. And what that means is you don't have enough vitamin K2 to make sure all of your K2 proteins are doing what they should at all times. So you might not notice it, and that's the problem. You might not notice K2 deficiency, but slowly you're losing bone density, or slowly you're building plaque in your arteries, or slowly cancer cells are growing out of control. But this may take 10 or 20 or more years, 30 years even, to see a problem. So that's where K2 deficiency is common and insidious. It can happen for a long time before you notice.
Why is K2 lacking from our diets today?
A few reasons. First of all is the change in our diet from grass-fed to grain-fed foods. So grass-fed foods and animals being on pasture is a common way that we would have K2 in our diets. And when we change animals from grass feeding to grain feeding, our K2 intake took a big hit. And also not eating as many fermented foods, because that's another source of vitamin K2 in our diets, is certain but not all types of fermented foods. It depends on the bacteria. They will be a good source of vitamin K2. We don't consume as many of those now as we once did. It's also not as much part of a North American culture as is of some other cultures. Also, trans fats, the invention of trans fat, that really, trans fat interferes with our ability to process and metabolize all types of vitamin K. And so that also affects, or has affected as a population, our K2 status.
And Sally Fallon has done an excellent video called The Oiling of America that exposes the whole vegetable oil trans fat scam. And I highly recommend that. That's what woke me up to the whole thing about 4 or 5 years ago. All right, so what happens to foods when they have K2, such as butter, eggs, etc.?
What happens?
And I think I jumped ahead, you know, because I didn't say so. What foods? Let's.
All right.
Let's say what foods, and ladies and gentlemen, and ignore the rest of that question.
Yeah, and this is what people want to hear, right?
What foods?
Right. So, well, as I suggested, you know, first of all, grass-fed foods. So if you can get your meat, your
eggs. You're not talking about the grass itself. You're talking about grass-fed foods. So.
Right. So, you know, we should probably say, you know, what foods don't have K2? Green leafy vegetables. So we as humans are not very efficient at eating green leafy vegetables and turning the K1 in those greens into K2. We do a little bit, but really not.
So we're not like gorillas. We don't have the fermenting capacity in our guts to convert all of that.
We're not actually, even gorillas, it would suggest, and our primate ancestors are not good at doing this conversion, and they need pre-converted K2, but we're certainly not like any herbivores, you know, cows, chickens, pigs, all that, all those kind of creatures who, you know, thrive primarily on eating grass. They make that conversion very well because they have to. But for some reason, humans lost that ability along the way, or maybe we never had it. But so we can't do that very much. So we need to get it in pre-converted form. So grass-fed food, so let the animals do the converting, and we get vitamin K2 in, you know, butter, eggs, egg yolks in particular, because this is a fat-soluble vitamin. So we have to remember that grass-fed meat is a good thing, but it's generally pretty low in fat. And since this is a fat-soluble vitamin, you won't get much K2 in the meat itself. Organ meats are good. Goose, for some reason, seems to be pretty high. Goose liver, very high, and goose leg is higher than, say, chicken leg. But any animal food, if it's grass-fed, will have more K2 in it. And then the other group of foods that are high K2 are certain types of fermented foods. So the highest known food is natto. It's a Japanese fermented soybean food. We could talk about that shortly. And some types of cheeses, but not all. So again, it depends on the bacteria. Brie and Gouda seem to be very high in K2. Some types of blue cheese, that's new information, but so again, you know, the milk that goes into that cheese doesn't need to be grass-fed because the bacteria will make the vitamin K2.
But should be anyway.
Pardon? It would be nice, yeah. It'd be nice if it was grass-fed raw.
I noticed that when I do get intestinal problems from milk, it's usually pasteurized and, you know, well, pasteurized is the biggest thing, but also if it's organic and raw, I don't seem to have any problems from it. And I know that's the case with most people and the drug, what is it, lactate that gets destroyed so that people become lactose intolerant.
Yeah, raw dairy is much easier to digest for most people, but if you can tolerate it or if you can't find that, then you'll still get the K2, fortunately, in regular cheese, Gouda, and brie. And, yeah.
All right, so back to my other question, and I suppose they even added yellow color to margarine, et cetera, to fool all of us back in the 40s. But what happens to foods when they have K2, such as butter and eggs?
So K2 itself doesn't have any color really, but it often travels with beta carotene. So grass that's growing rapidly will have lots of beta carotene and lots of vitamin K1, and those will tend to travel together. The beta carotene lends an orange color to the egg yolk, for example, and that's a sign that yolk is also high in vitamin K2 because those nutrients tend to travel together. So most people who have had truly free-range eggs from, you know, chickens that are out on pasture will notice those egg yolks are really orange in color, and that's a sign they're also high in K2.
Yeah, goose eggs. Woo, those bright, bright orange. Yeah. And let's see. And that's where the yellow comes from and the butter as well.
Yeah, and butter will do the same thing.
And so, you know, that's why it's so important, you know, and in the United States, the selection of good butters is slim to none. There's Humboldt Creamery, and, you know, theirs doesn't taste anything near as good as say, Kerrygold. And then there's maybe one or two others, but, you know, you can tell it, you know, and I drink... my bulletproof coffee every day, and you can really tell the difference between, say, Kerrygold and even the so-called pasture butters from the U.S. The U.S. stuff doesn't compare. And as soon as you try to get one gulp down of your bulletproof coffee, you go, you know, oh, something's not right with this butter here. So, it is key to get good, clean butter. And unfortunately, in the U.S., that's really hard to get. And I hear it's not so easy in Canada either.
I think it's even tougher up here. There's all kinds of archaic laws and about importing butter and how, you know, how the butter should be produced. And it's tough. It's tough. And that's why I use the example of eggs. Because most people have seen, if they're, you know, being conscious of this, they've seen a, you know, a grass-fed orange egg yolk. Most people have not seen that grass-fed butter. It's really hard to find.
Yeah, well, and all of their regulations, which, you know, lends to the point that they're actually, in fact, they are making people sicker and sicker, and they've never, you know, governments, I don't think, are in the business of actually protecting the people. And certainly hospitals would make less money, not more, if people were eating lots of, you know, grass-fed, meats and butters and cheeses and things like that. So on page 58 of your book, you talk about good eggs having less cholesterol and saturated fat, but mounting evidence shows that animal cholesterol and saturated fat is not harmful and, in fact, helpful, the brain being made of cholesterol and burning fat. So why would an egg with a third less cholesterol be better for us? Or let me just, you know, and I know you readdress the issue on page 90 later on in your book. So I just wanted to have you clarify this issue, like ghee.
Right. I always get nervous when people mention page numbers because I've got to go back and check it. But The idea there is that when the chicken gets out on pasture and has grass in its diet, you will see a whole change in the profile of either, you know, the egg or the egg yolk, as well as meat, for example, grass-fed meat. And not that the lowering of cholesterol in the egg is what is better about the egg, but there's been a whole change in the nutrient profile, the types of fats you find in there, that has improved the nutrition of the egg in general. And the same thing applies to grass-fed meat. And so it's that, the types of fats that you'll find. And when you have a grain-fed egg, yes, it's higher in cholesterol. That's not necessarily the issue in and of itself, but the profile of fats and the types of fats you'll see in there that reflect the chicken's diet of eating grain is really the problem.
Okay. Yeah, I think also there you say, some grass-fed beef is better because of low fat. But, you know, again, I think this is where Dave Asprey's information is important, because when he's looking at the grain-fed diet, he's also looking at mycotoxins involved in the grains, which would again lead to inflammation, lots of sugar in these animals' bodies. You know, of course, that's the whole point, because they want to slaughter them in half the time that they normally would. So,
and that's really the issue, exactly. It's not that, so yes, grass-fed meat is lower in fat. That's just natural based on the diet. That doesn't make the meat better per se. You have a different types of fats, but I mean, like, I'll admit I love a nice marbled steak as much as the next person, but I don't like to think about the fact that when a steak is marbled like that, it's because of this grain feeding that's causing infiltration of fat into the tissues. These are animals that if left on their own, they'd be developing metabolic syndrome and diabetes and horrendous, you know, diseases. It's not a healthy animal, but we just have a taste for fat that's very ingrained in us. So you just want to get that from the best sources that you have.
Why would we have an ingrained taste for fat? Jeez.
Isn't that funny? Yes.
And then, you know, isn't it interesting how the snack companies, of course, they co-opt that and our need for salt as well. So they get us to associate salt to salty snack instead, mm-hmm. right? So, you know.
And the body never had to differentiate between good salt and bad salt, or right. good fat. Bad fat, it was like, yeah.
And it wasn't usually attached to grains and wheat every time you got it. So, you know, if you realize that a lot of times, you know, if you realize, oh, snack craving, wait, that's not snack craving, it's salt craving. Mm-hmm. And you just put a little pinch of salt in your water and you drink it. Oh, look at that. The snack craving suddenly went away. You know, it's like, wow, that's pretty neat. All right, you discuss two types of vitamin K2. What are these two types? And you mainly focus on, there may have been something else. I think it was MK4 and MK7, which we just touched on.
Right. So there's two types of vitamin K2. There's a short chain form and a long chain form. The short chain forms are present naturally in grass-fed foods, grass-fed animal foods. The long chain forms, the short chain form is called MK4. Long chain forms, MK5, 6, 7, 8, all the way to 10 different lengths. You'll find those in fermented foods. So different fermented foods are higher or lower, like in different types of vitamin K2. So cheeses are often high in MK8, 9, and 10. Natto, this Japanese fermented soybean food, is very high in MK7 and menaquinone 7. And because the MK4 short chain form and MK7 are also the two types of vitamin K2 that you'll find in supplements, that's why there's a focus on these two types, the short chain and long chain forms.
Isn't most bad or LDL cholesterol from grains?
Yes. So the LDL cholesterol and the oxidized LDL cholesterol is typically brought on by a diet that's high in grains and sugars, much more so. It's a much easier way to increase your LDL and your oxidized LDL cholesterol than eating fat or saturated fat.
And you get the guy on the TV, oh, you got to have your Quaker oats, you know. and it's good for your heart. And meanwhile, he's this big around, you know. You know, and Sally Fallon and Mary Enig, they kind of make it clear that it was intentional that this was done. But why do you think the cholesterol caused from grains and sugars was superimposed on top of meat cholesterol to make it appear that it was actually the meats and the fats doing the damage?
Well, I have to say I'm a big fan of Gary Tobes' book, Good Calories, Bad Calories. I think anybody who is really wants to know about the history of that, you know, the lipid hypothesis and the saturated fat theory, exactly, and how that came to be so entrenched. It's a big and it's a thorough read about the history of that. Ansel Keys getting on the board of the American Heart Association, that kind of thing, and pushing that idea forward until we got to a point that no researcher could publish a paper that said anything but saturated fat causes heart disease, despite the fact there was really no good evidence to that. Did that get carried away with because there's drugs to lower the cholesterol or treat those things? I'm not sure about that, but you know, it's finally coming back around. The research is certainly coming back around, but the message is not getting out that there wasn't a lot of good evidence and research around saturated fat and heart disease.
It seems that the naturopathic doctors are about the only group out there that are promoting the high-fat diet pretty heavily. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I had this guy on, Dr. Peter Glidden, who's a naturopath. He works with Dr. Wallach selling the longevity vitamins and stuff. But, you know, he wrote this book showing that this group had actually paid to fund all of this stuff and to keep people away from basic understanding of nutritional sources. And when you realize the joke, if you can put it that way, it's more of a really sick joke, I guess. You know, about wheat and grains and the low-fat diet and the impact on the brain and the reproductive system and all of this stuff, it doesn't really paint a pretty picture. And, you know, if you go back to Plato's Republic, you know, and on my website, there's an episode with Will Durant on there talking about Plato promoting the low-fat diet 2,500 years ago to control the masses. And you look at the things that they're doing now and in this republic, quote unquote, and it's very parallel, I would say.
Well, you know, I suspect that it's more about money than controlling the masses, but I guess they sort of go together.
Right. Well, and yeah, for sure. All right, so how do trans fats and hydrogenated polyunsaturated fats harm us?
Well, I think that most people are aware that trans fats, which were meant to be, you know, solid versions of fats that were to replace butter, but supposedly better for us because they were not full of the demonized saturated fat, but they ended up being a lot more problematic on just so many different levels. The fact is that our bodies, they're entirely artificial, and our bodies just did not have a way of processing and dealing with them. But the polyunsaturated fats, it's a little harder for people to wrap their minds around, even if they're not esterified or you know, made into a trans fat or a margarine, that they could be problematic because they got, you know, such good PR in terms of vegetable oils being good for us. But the fact is that, you know, chemically, when you look at them, because they're polyunsaturated, in other words, not saturated at many different sites, they're more prone to being damaged. They're more prone to being damaged when you heat them, and they're more prone to being damaged after you consume them.
Well, and even important also, let me just interject here, oxidization. And so the reason why they are poly means many, and unsaturated means that there are many points that are open, essentially, mm-hmm. to oxidization and damage. And right. So these polyunsaturated fats, the only way that they can keep them in a bottle of canola or Mazola or whatever on the shelf in the store is to use chlorine and Drano and all of these hideous chemicals to keep them stable. Otherwise, they go rancid after a week or two and you have to throw them away. So sorry to interrupt you there.
Yeah. No, but that's exactly it. And I, of course, I speak about fat in just about every talk that I'm doing. And it's tough for some people to wrap their minds around what kinds of fats they should be eating. And most people out there are still stuck on the saturated fat thing. And when I tell them they should eat the yolks, it's the better part of the egg. It can prompt some really interesting reactions. So a rule of thumb I try to give is, if I'm trying to get people to figure out what kind of fats they should or shouldn't be eating, did their grandparents eat it, or could their grandparents have eaten it? And could they, in theory, make it at home? In other words, if you had some coconuts and some time on your hands, you could make coconut fat. If you had some olives in a press, you could do that too. If you had a cow, you could make butter, or even just some cream. But no matter how much time you have on your hands, you could never make corn oil, because you absolutely need an industrial process. Right. And so we just never ate that kind of oil in such large amounts.
And, you know, what I should do is, you know, so monounsaturated fats, which are coconut oil and olive oil and palm kernel oil, there might be a couple of others out there. There's not a whole lot of them. The reason why these oils get less damage is because there's one place, mono, where they are unsaturated. So they're monounsaturated versus. That's why polyunsaturateds are so much more toxic for us, and they were only invented less than 100 years ago. Monounsaturateds have been historical staples of the human diet, plant sources for oil. And then saturated fats, the reason why they are the most healthy for us is because they are entirely saturated. In other words, there are no spaces open in the molecule where oxidization or damage can happen. So what they did is they spun all of the information and basically made us believe that oils that couldn't be damaged, that we could consume wholly and healthily, that we would get out of pig fat or an egg or whatever, were bad. And then all of these man-made Frankenstein oils that came from polyunsaturated fats were therefore healthy. So everybody, you know, literally, you know, even here in California, it's illegal for restaurants to use lard in making like Mexican food. In California. So the state has forced people in restaurant owners to serve toxic polyunsaturated oils in their foods as protecting the population. I mean, you know, this
lard
is the...
Lard got the worst rap. I don't know why, but lard got the worst rap of all of them. And yeah, it's a real shame because it is so...
And tallow as well. You know, and in fact, the day that French fries became unhealthy was the day that they started frying them in polyunsaturated oils, which was in the early 1980s. So, you know, before early 1980s, 83, 84 or so, you could technically eat French fries that were actually pretty healthy for you, regardless if they were fried. I mean, there might be a little bit of damage there in the frying, but compared to today, they were far, far healthier for us.
Oh, yeah. You know, I recently found a place, fortunately, right where I live, where they were selling pastured lard. So this is lard, not pasteurized, but lard from grass-fed pigs in jars. I thought I hit pay dirt, and I scooped it all up, like, in my arms full, with all these jars of lard. And the guy looked at me and he said, "We can't give that stuff away. Like, what are you doing?" I said, "Wait till the word gets out, because this is nutritional gold."
And here you are, you're like, you know, I wrote a book on this stuff. So let's see. What things should people be looking out for on food labels regarding trans fats?
Don't trust the food labels when it comes to trans fat. I guess if you're using that as your gauge, you may be led astray, because in terms of the actual, you know, listing of how much trans fat is in your food, just look at the ingredients, because lots of, you know, commercial peanut butter, for example, lists hydrogenated oil right on the list of ingredients, but the trans fats is listed as zero on the label, which how can that be? So yeah, it's a bit of a game in terms of how much is in there per serving. The trans fats listed under a number of pseudonyms. That doesn't count. But
monoglycerides, diglycerides, yes, hydrogenated, partially hydrogenated. And here's a tip, folks, if you eat peanut butter, and that's on Dave Asprey's no list because of mycotoxins. But if you do eat peanut butter, here's a simple rule that the ingredients should say. They should say peanuts, salt, period. And if you can't get that, a lot of stores will have a peanut crusher that you pour the peanuts in the top and peanut butter comes out the bottom. So real easy trick to make sure that you're not getting, you know, I mean, if you're eating...
That's if you're still eating peanut butter.
That's if you're silly. But if you're eating like some of the major brands, I don't know if I should say them. Maybe I should just stay away. Yeah. But, you know, if they have sugar and hydrogenated oils and stuff in them, don't buy them. All right, so you mentioned this stuff, natto, before, that the comes from around the Tokyo area in Japan. Let's get into natto. What is this gooey, slimy, delicious stuff that you love to eat with every meal? I'm totally kidding on that last part.
Famous or infamous Japanese breakfast food, and it becomes controversial for lots of different reasons. But, you know, I just shared my own story of trying to find it because it's the holy grail of vitamin K2 intake. It's the highest known food in vitamin K2.
And that's vitamin K2 MK7.
MK7, yeah. So it's a fermented long form, and almost exclusively this MK7. The bacteria that ferment the soybeans make a lot of vitamin K2. And studies have shown that where they eat this in Japan, they don't eat it everywhere, but there's areas where they eat this. The people there have much better bone health, heart health. It makes a real impact on health, the K2 intake from this one food. But it is can be very hard to find. It is certainly an acquired taste. I have since, you know, after writing my book, I still struggle with eating it. I eat it because I know it's good for me. And I've come to think that there may be some, like a genetic component here, because I know people who try it and love it right away, or very soon after, or after trying it, they start to crave it. And it still hasn't happened for me yet. And natto lovers, you know, email me and accuse me of you know, trying to put it down, or that I'm suggesting people are better off taking supplements. I'm not. If you can eat natto, go for it. And it is just, it has a very unusual texture and a musty flavor, but some people just love it, and which I think is great. And yes, I do encourage people to try it because you might love it.
And you describe it in your book as like a cobweb slime.
Oh, it's very, very slimy and sticky. And yes, they're very thin filaments that are quite a bit like cobwebs. Yeah, that come off it when you eat it.
All right. So now this natto stuff is actually made from soy. And on page 74 of your book, you discuss... Soy is a source of isoflavones, a source of estrogen-like compounds, which to me is the exact reason why we shouldn't eat soy, especially the male half of the population. And then you do admit that it's albeit contested in your book there. But isn't soy also listed even by the FDA as a poison for human consumption? And should males be eating any amount of soy, especially with its known high estrogen content, and of course, baby foods and formulas and things like that have an extremely high amount of soy, which I think is in wrecking the male population, possibly intentionally, which may lead also to the lower testosterone count, included on top of the issue with the lack of K2 and fats in the diet.
Well, I'm certainly not a soy promoter in any sense. I don't believe that soy belongs in baby food in any form. And, you know, soy milk, the type and amount of soy that's finding its way into all of our foods, really, it has no place there. But there is a tradition of eating fermented soy foods in small amounts. So this is miso, tempeh, and natto. And the fermentation affects the phytoestrogens and the goitrogens and the other problems that we have with soy and neutralizes those compounds. So I think, and there's certainly a lot of examples of people eating, for example, natto and being able to be healthy. Other than that, I'm not a big fan of soy, but I know that some people still have concerns around soy, even just GMO. If you're concerned about GMO, it's very, very difficult to find non-GMO soy. And so I know people who are using the natto culture to ferment black beans, turtle beans, their own legumes. And that, because it's the bacteria that make the vitamin K2, you don't have to have the soybeans. You can have non-soy natto, essentially, by fermenting other legumes and still get those same benefits.
So for those who want, and in my own family, there are people who, if they have any amount of soy, they'll have an extreme reaction to it, within 10 to 20 minutes, even a complete intestinal breakdown, essentially. But, for those of us who want to stay completely away from soy products, what are the other best food sources for K2 from, and what foods do we get K2 from? And we kind of touched on some of them a bit ago, but you and aside from legumes and pointing out for the bulletproof people out there, again, legumes are on the bad list, not on the good list, so.
Right. So there are still lots of other options. And this is where K2 science, it's one of the areas where K2 science is certainly lacking, because I suspect that there are a lot more foods that are higher in K2 than we know of, but there hasn't been that much testing to date. And some of the ones that are high up on the list are unusual foods, like goose liver happens to be very high, but not something that people are necessarily getting into their diet very much. And again, those certain types of cheeses, brie and gouda, some types of blue cheese, ghee, so grass-fed ghee, so this is a butter oil concentrate, traditional Indian food, for example, that is likely very high in vitamin K2. It's something that needs to be tested, but, based on Price's work as well as what we know about butter. And those grass-fed eggs, these are among the highest foods. And if for whatever reason you can't have those foods, then this is a good time to look at supplements.
Now, what about those such as Dave Asprey who say not to eat cheeses because of the mycotoxins?
So again, this is I thought Dave was going to hang up on me when we were having our interview and I said, eat brie. but for people who are very sensitive, then that may be an issue. We do know from the research that cheese intake seems to be the biggest determinant of K2 intake for most people, most European populations in particular. So we know that the people with the highest K2 intake have the lowest incidence of heart disease, for example, from the Rotterdam study, and that K2 intake was determined almost entirely by cheese. Same thing, individuals, men with the highest intake of K2 have the lowest incidence of prostate and lung cancer, regardless of smoking status. And that is also determined by cheese intake. A couple studies out recently showing that cheese intake, the higher amounts of dairy, and particularly cheese and high-fat dairy, is associated with less diabetes, slimmer waistline, metabolic disease. So we certainly see a lot of benefits from the K2 intake from cheese in particular. But if you think cheese is a concern for you due to the dairy, due to the mycotoxins, then you got to look at supplements or other ways of getting your K2.
Now, are there unfermented cheeses, or is it the fermentation process that brings out the K2? I mean, can you go to other cheeses? Would cottage cheese or some other form of cheese, if you could get it, raw milk, would that?
Well, it's interesting you should ask about that, because one of the early studies about the K2 intake of foods, and this is Dutch research, listed curd cheese as one of the highest foods in K2. Now, there still would likely be some bacteria involved in here. I didn't list that in my book because I haven't been able to determine what curd cheese in the Netherlands means here in North America. So does that mean cottage cheese? I think it might. Other people have said, no, it's like a drier curd. So I didn't want to be suggesting the wrong foods, but cottage cheese might be high, or whatever constitutes curd cheese. Some people have said it's cork. Some people have, there's some debate about what that type of cheese is here.
I would imagine that feta cheese would be high in it too, if different curd cheeses are, you know. And I've been in places like Zlatibor in Serbia. I used to live in Serbia for a year and a half, and some of the most incredible cheeses I've ever had way up in this gold forest, way up in the mountains. And all, you know, the farmers would line up every day, and you could go around and taste each of these different cheeses. Right. And I think that would be, you know, because feta is such a huge daily part of the European diet. So I would think that that would be another good place to look. So what about K2 supplements? You state that synthetic or man-made MK4 is sourced from tobacco, or I don't know if it's synthetic, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, sourced from tobacco plants, from tobacco, so there's nicotiana.
Yeah, so there's two types of K2, two main types of K2 supplements that you'll find on the market. Again, the MK4, short chain, and the MK7, usually long chain. Now, the MK4, even though that is the form of vitamin K2 that we find in grass-fed foods, that's not where it comes from in the supplements. It's a synthetic source from the supplements. Now, regardless of your feeling on, you know, synthetic versus natural sources of K2, most of the initial research used this form of K2, this synthetic MK4. It's been found to be safe and effective. You know, lots of good research on that. The research using the newer MK7 supplements, so those are derived typically from natto, so it's natural bacterial fermentation that you get the MK7. The research is newer there. It's still catching up. It looks like it's as safe, and it would seem to be as effective. But just to know that these are two different sources of vitamin K2 that you'll find in the supplements, and they act just a little bit differently in the body. As far as we know, they are both as useful, as helpful, but it would seem the dosing differs a little bit because they have different half-lives and different actions in the body.
And I forgot to ask you a question. I wanted to ask you about the water cure from Dr. Bamangalij. Mm-hmm. What do you think about his work on water and salt, etc.?
I do think it's interesting, and I have looked at it a little bit, sort of. It's always in the back of my mind there, because it is something I think that's worth approaching as a very, you know, basic, you know, addressing your basic health. I wonder how much is the water and how much is the salt, and how those combine. You know, salt's gotten such a bad rap, and the type of salt we're having and the amounts, and that is intriguing information to me. Yeah.
I, you know, the whole sodium salt thing is another huge scandal. I mean, obviously Gandhi overturned the British with salt, and you go down to Peru and you see these massive Inca salt mines in the Valley of the Kings, etc. And so, you know, and you think of our own history and Roman history, you're worth your weight in salt. We have this strange word when we go to work, we get a salary, meaning salt. And so, you know, they've taken this, you know, all of the information about salt, and they've spun, and then they, you know, most of the salt that you get in the store is like sodium and not your typical sea salt type stuff, with a lot of minerals as well. So, and I don't know if you can see it, but up there on that fridge over there, there's a 10-pound bag of sea salt. And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, instead of going and buying those little containers of sea salt, if you just go buy one big bag, it'll save you. It's like, it ends up being like 35 times cheaper or something like that. It's pretty ridiculous. So, yeah, the whole salt issue, I think, is very interesting. And I certainly feel better when I have more salt. Mm-hmm. So what are the dangers of vitamin K2? We haven't talked about that yet.
Actually, vitamin K2 is quite non-toxic. there, and that's been shown again and again in the studies. You know, certainly no dangers from overdosing on it in your diet. No drug interactions except for warfarin. That's the one exception, because warfarin is a drug that intentionally lowers your body's levels of vitamin K to prevent your blood from clotting. So if you take K in any form, whether it's K1 from green leafy vegetables or K2 from diet or supplements, that may interfere with the action of that medicine. But any other type of blood thinner, it's not an issue. Only the warfarin type blood thinner. So the new ones like Pradaxa, Effient, those things, they work on different mechanisms. Not to say that those are, you know, not without their drawbacks, but at least K2 or interaction with vitamin K isn't one of them. And very rarely, every now and then, I run across somebody who, when taking a K2 supplement, and it would seem it's only MK7 supplements, but I'm not sure about that, has a sensitivity to reaction to it. They may feel like their heart's beating faster. Some people have reported difficulty sleeping, but that's just a small handful of cases so far. Other than that, it's very, very safe.
And they were eating wheat.
Oh, yes, no doubt. Yeah.
All right. And I don't know if that last part was true or not. So how does K2 affect anti-aging, the triage theory?
So the triage theory posits that basically, you know, we need a certain amount of nutrients for optimum health. And if we're not getting the optimal levels of all of our nutrients, our body will essentially triage or kind of assign precedent to certain actions that those nutrients should be having in our bodies. And so if there is a lack, you may be more susceptible to long-term consequences. In other words, you can have a deficiency of vitamin K2 today and not notice and not feel particularly bad. And you might not notice for 2 or 3 decades that you've slowly been losing bone density or building plaque in your arteries or cancer cells growing out of control because of the way the body preferentially doles out nutrients or manages those nutrients if you're not getting enough of them all the time. And actually the first nutrient that was tested with this triage theory by the Ames group in California that looked at this is vitamin K2, and showing, in fact, yes, you can be deficient and not notice it today, but pay for it down the road.
All right. And this next question is going to cover 2 chapters in your book, 4 and 5. What are the health benefits of vitamin K2?
Oh boy. Okay. So
sorry.
Increased better bone density and bone mineral content and other aspects of bone health, less plaque in the arteries, less incidence of heart attack and stroke, less cancer, lung and prostate, the 2 bigger cancer killers for men, and other types of cancers as well. K2 boosts testosterone levels. That has a number of implications for men at all stages of life, but I think throughout adolescence it's particularly important. For children, their bone health, their dental health, we haven't even touched on dental health, such an important part of vitamin K2.
Oh, I think that's coming up here in just a second. Somewhere, but,
okay,
I hope.
Good.
Next question is...
Lots. Okay, yeah.
Don't worry, we didn't miss. You know, so we also have healthy veins, fertility, diabetes, cancer prevention, and you list a number of different types of cancers here. Kidney disease, you did mention facial development, teeth. Now, a while back I had on Rami, what's his last name, Noggle maybe, about curing tooth decay with the paleo diet. And so your work coincides with his, which of course is derived from Weston A. Price. But this is such an important issue. And so let's talk about vitamin K2 in teeth. In what way does K2 help tooth development?
So important. And a lot of people do find my work because of either for themselves or more often their children having such bad teeth, despite brushing and flossing and doing everything that they think they should be doing, that the teeth are just rotting away. And people find it that way. Sadly, you know, people who have been following a vegan diet will then start to develop tooth problems, and that's what eventually leads them to my book. And I'm never happy to hear that.
Yeah, it was the single worst thing I ever did to my health was being a vegan.
And it's heartbreaking because I know people who do that are doing it for very good reasons, you know, environmental reasons and personal and health reasons, then have to suffer such a big price for it.
Well, and to counter on the environmental reasons, when you look at the whole issue, like I had on, the bug girl, now I'm forgetting her name. We did a whole show on entomophagy and eating bugs. And, you know, she lays out the issue, you know, and there's another book that I've been meaning to interview the author of that covers this issue as well. But tractors going through fields destroy large parts of the environment. You know, as somebody who eats a cow, they know exactly how many animals they're killing. The tractor will kill the birds, the snakes, the lizards, the insects, and, you know, rabbits, anything else that's in that field, birds, anything, nests, everything that's in there, it's going to get killed. So furthermore, the cattle spread the seeds, the birds, the chickens, everything follow behind the cattle. You know, the North American continent had tens of millions of buffalo roaming it. They never destroyed the environment. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I this is just more evidence that this whole promotion, you know, heavily in the media and all the TV shows and everything these days is propaganda based, because, you know, if the real concern were for the environment, we wouldn't be going away from eating steak and potatoes.
Oh, well, you know, a feedlot will ruin your environment, no doubt about that, but properly managed pastures and animals out on that pasture will improve the soil quality, the environment and the air quality and everything else. But, you know, just backing up for a second, bugs are a very good source of vitamin K2, by the way, insects. That was likely ancestors, primate ancestors, termites in particular, and termite dung, their source of vitamin K2.
And that was Daniela Martin, who, you know, and I need to have her back on. I think she sent me her book recently. Yep, it's right there. Oops. So, and by the way, she's got a book out too, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, so back to our questions here. So can taking K2 at a young age help to stop misdeveloped teeth and arch?
Yes, this is, again, another area where K2 research is lacking, but we have really interesting evidence to see what happens when K2 deficiency very specifically occurs, unfortunately, due to the example of the drug warfarin. Warfarin robs the body of vitamin K2, and that alone, and you can see a lot of effects on that, effects in fetal development, for example, and what happens to the face. When that happens, the face becomes very, very narrow. And this is exactly what Price described in his work. And we know that vitamin K2 is important for proper facial development, both in the growing fetus, so really important nutrient for prenatal development, tooth development, nice wide face. But it would seem that there is likely, even after birth and throughout childhood and adolescence, still a chance for the face to catch up. So we know that vitamin K2 boosts testosterone levels in men, for example. And we know that higher testosterone levels in adolescence helps create a wider face. And so there's likely still time for the jaw and the face to catch up, to widen, to make room for all those teeth. And we know K2 is important for dental health. That's the one place where people will remark that they notice when they're taking K2 or increasing their K2 intake, that their teeth are cleaner. And this seems to have a number of impacts. We know the K2 will concentrate in the saliva glands and basically get squirted onto the teeth, keep the mouth healthy and clean. And this is an area where K2 research, I think, is really lacking, is the dental health area.
How can people test their K2 levels?
The best tests for K2 status are only available in an academic setting right now. They're not available to practitioners, so you can't at this point really test it yourself.
Vitamins K2, A, and D. Why are these three important together?
We could have a whole show just on that, but basically Vitamin D helps you absorb calcium. K2 moves it around the body. And A removes calcium from the body when that's appropriate, because sometimes that is appropriate. And so they really all do work together. That's just on one facet of our health, that calcium metabolism. Vitamins A and D work together to control and regulate the production of the vitamin K2-dependent proteins.
Let's get into, I know you got to love this one, phytic acid and whole grains.
So there's been so much focus on eating whole grains, but a big part of that story has been missed, in that grains need to be, they're potentially very healthy, but they really do need to be processed in a very, very particular way. The way that people would traditionally have processed them, through long soaking times or fermenting times, things like sourdough, soured porridge, soaked grains, that kind of thing, sprouted grains. And if that isn't done, then the grains may be doing more harm than good. This is, of course, a principle of the Weston A. Price Foundation diet, and it is they're tricky. The grains can be tricky.
And of course, Dave Asprey just says, you know, to stay away entirely from the grains, primarily because of the mycotoxin issue. But you know, and so you know, my question to you is: can people really eat safe wheat by soaking it overnight or for a couple of days or something? Do you really think it's safe then, or is that pushing the envelope a little too far?
Well, wheat's another kind of issue altogether, because of the way the wheat has been hybridized, and modern dwarf wheat has a whole other set of problems above and beyond just the phytic acid. And I'm sure, you know, you and Bill Davis got into that during your interview.
Well, so, and he even had looked at ancient Rome and had found cases of celiac even with the ancient wheat. So
right. So wheat in itself, modern wheat and wheat in itself is especially problematic. So you want to almost leave that off the table. But even looking at other grains, can other grains be consumed? I think some grains are less problematic than others. You know, soaked oats, for example, can be in a certain amount part of a healthy diet. And I think that the tradition of fermenting grains, as well, like in sourdough or in other ways, were likely ways that people were able to benefit from the grains.
Now, the other issue, obviously, with with wheat, even rice, is that when you eat these grains, you're going to spike your insulin levels through the roof. And so, of course, that can lead to diabetes, especially if you don't have enough K2, right?
Yep, right.
Yeah. All right. And so I'm just ad-libbing here, so let me know if I'm wrong. And then let's see. So then, again, you have the issue with the LDL cholesterol, and then you have phytic acid. Now, phytic acid, that's why you don't eat spinach raw. And, you know, that's why spinach is always recommended cooked. That's more
about oxalates, but yeah, you want to have your spinach cooked and preferably with something creamy.
Right. And then doesn't raw kale have a very large amount of phytic acid as well?
Yeah, again, a lot of these greens, the oxalates are problematic. I'm not a fan of raw kale, eating it.
You see all of these, you know, hippie vegans and vegetarians everywhere munching and crunching and juicing this stuff all over the place, and it's hugely damaging. It's not a good thing. All right, so one more here. What about Valium in wheat?
You know, wheat does have a certain amount of natural, I guess you could say, mood enhancers, mood boosters, chemicals that connect to our body's receptors for endorphins, and you can get a buzz off of it. And some people do. And this is the mechanism behind their truly addictive quality. I happen to be affected that way.
I have to tell you, you know, when we first started doing the shows on weed and everything here, that was probably people's biggest issue was, you know, and we had at least 1,000 emails. Every single one of them said the same thing about quitting eating wheat. But the biggest issue that they had was quitting eating the wheat, because obviously wheat affects the opium receptors in the brain. And so you're actually addicted to it. So it's like being addicted to heroin. So it usually takes most of these people about 2 to 2.5 weeks to get past the addiction point. And then what you do is you go out and you look for all of these substitutes. And you'll go on a substitute hunt for 3 or 6 months. And then one day you realize that's all crap too. And then after all of that, then you just kind of give it all up and you step away from the grains and suddenly you feel a whole lot better. But I had actually sent this study to Bill Davis. He hadn't seen it. And it's from Wildman et al. 1987. Diazepam and desmethyldiazepam are found in rat brain and adrenal and maybe of plant origin. And then a follow-up study, in wheat grains, diazepam and desmethyldiazepam could be identified by HPLC and analysis by gas chromatography combined with mass spectrometry. So indeed, at minimum, aside from it affecting the opium receptors and being addictive, and you need all those salty snacks all of the time, it's drugging you with Valium. So, you know, the reason why most people, they get that fog that lifts off their brain after a couple of weeks of not eating it, it very well could be that you've been eating Valium for breakfast, Valium with your burger for lunch and your pizza, Valium for dinner with your lasagna and your roll. So, you know, if you're high on Valium all of the time, you know, it's gonna make your brain a little foggy. All right. What is the single most important concept, Kate, that you would like people to take away from this interview?
Especially if you've been taking vitamin D, which I think most people, you know, listening to this or even doing any kind of research on their health probably is, that we've been missing a big part of the picture. Having overlooked vitamin K2, it's a nutrient that is so incredibly important for our health, and it really does fit the big piece of the puzzle that has been missing, and it's one that is worth understanding to try to get back a balance of those fat-soluble vitamins, get all the benefits you've been wanting from the vitamin D, and protecting your health in ways that you may not have realized before.
All right. And the name of your book, what's your website, any contact information that you may or may not want the public to have?
So Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox, How a Little Known Vitamin Could Save Your Life is the name of the book. That's it right there with the Tower of Cheese.
With your nice autograph right there. Thank you, Kate.
That's right. And my website is www.drkatend.com, and you can email me through there, and I will eventually get back to you, although it depends when I get your email. But yeah, you can feel free to send questions through there.
And that's all I have for you, Kate. Did you have any last-moment thoughts you'd like to add? Did we miss anything that would be important to include?
No, I think that we've done a really good job of you know, covering K2, and just thanks so much, because I know your listeners are really ahead of the curve on getting this information, and it is really helpful. So thanks for getting the word out about vitamin K2. Yeah, and I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, and thank you for coming on.